and bubbly as the miles rolled up on the odometer, but Bobby knew that her sprightly mood was not genuine. Each time they set out to visit her brother Thomas, she worked hard to inflate her spirits. Although she loved Thomas, every time that she was with him, her heart broke anew, so she had to fortify herself in advance with manufactured good humor. "Not a cloud in the sky," she said as they passed the old Irvine Ranch fruit-packing plant. "Isn't it a beautiful day, Bobby?" "It's a wonderful day," he agreed. "The wind must have pushed the clouds all the way to Japan, piled them up miles high over Tokyo." "Yeah, right now California litter is falling on the Ginza." Hundreds of red bougainvillea blossoms, stripped from their vines by the wind, blew across the road, and for a moment the samurai seemed to be caught in a crimson snowstorm. Maybe it was because they'd just spoken of Japan, but there was something oriental about the whirl of petals. He would not have been surprised to glimpse a kimono-clad woman at the side of the road, dappled in sunshine and shadow. "Even a windstorm is beautiful here," Julie said. "Aren't we lucky, Bobby? Aren't we lucky to be living in this special place?" Shaw's Frenzy struck up, "String Rich Swing." Every time he heard the song, Bobby was almost able to imagine that he was in a movie from the 1930s or 40s, and he would turn a corner and encounter his old friend Jimmy Stewart, or maybe Bing Crosby, and they'd go off to have lunch with Cary Grant and Jean Arthur and Katharine Hepburn, and screwball things would happen. "What movie are you in?" Julie asked. She knew him too well. "Haven't figured it out yet. Maybe The Philadelphia Story." By the time they pulled into the parking lot of Cielo Vista Care Home, Julie had whipped herself into a state of high good humor. She got out of the samurai, faced west, and grinned at the horizon, which was delineated by the marriage of sea and sky, as if she had never encountered a sight to match it. In truth, it was a stunning panorama, because Cielo Vista stood on a bluff half a mile from the Pacific, overlooking a long stretch of Southern California's Gold Coast. Bobby admired it, too, shoulders hunched slightly and head tucked down, in deference to the cool and blustery wind. When Julie was ready, she took Bobby's hand and squeezed it hard, and they went inside. Cielo Vista Care Home was a private facility, operated without government funds, and its architecture eschewed all of the standard institutional looks. Its two-story Spanish facade of pale peach stucco was accented by white marble corner pieces, door frames, and window lintels. White-painted French windows and doors were recessed in graceful arches with deep sills. The sidewalks were shaded by lattice arbors, draped with a mix of purple and yellow-blooming bougainvillea, from which the wind drew a chorus of urgent whispers. Inside, the floors were gray vinyl tiles speckled with peach and turquoise, and the walls were peach with white base and crown molding, which lent the place a warm and airy ambience. They paused in the foyer just inside the front door, while Julie withdrew a comb from her purse and pulled the wind tangles from her hair. After stopping at the front desk in the cozy visitor's lobby, they followed the north hall to Thomas's first-floor room. His was the second of the two beds, nearest the windows, but he was neither there nor in his armchair. When they stopped in his open doorway, he was sitting at a work table that belonged to both him and his roommate, Derek. Bent over the table, using a pair of scissors to clip a photograph from a magazine, Thomas appeared, curiously both hulking and fragile, thick-set yet delicate. Physically, he was solid, but mentally and emotionally, he was frail, and that inner weakness shone through to belie the outer image of strength. With his thick neck, heavy rounded shoulders, broad back, proportionally short arms and stocky legs, Thomas had a gnomish look. But when he became aware of them and turned his head to see who was there, his face was not graced by the cute and beguiling features of a fairy tale creature. It was instead a face of cruel genetic destiny and biological tragedy. "Jules," he said, dropping the scissors and magazine, nearly knocking over his chair in his haste to get up. He was wearing baggy jeans and a green plaid flannel shirt. He seemed 10 years younger than his true age. "Jules! Jules!" Julie let go of Bobby's hand and stepped into the room, opening her arms to her brother. "Hi, honey." Thomas hurried to her in that shuffling walk of his, as if his shoes were heeled and soled with enough iron to preclude his lifting them. Although he was 20 years old, 10 years younger than Julie, he was 4 inches shorter than she, barely 5 feet. He had been born with Down syndrome, a diagnosis that even a layman could read in his face. His brow was sloped and heavy. Inner epicanthic folds gave his eyes an oriental cast. The bridge of his nose was flat, his ears were low set on a head that was slightly too small to be in proportion to his body. The rest of his features had those soft, heavy contours often associated with mental retardation. Though it was a countenance shaped more for expressions of sadness and loneliness, it now defied its naturally downcast lines and formed itself into a wondrous smile, a warm grin of pure delight. Julie always had that effect on Thomas. Hell, she has that effect on me, Bobby thought. Stooping only slightly, Julie threw her arms around her brother when he came to her, and for a while they hugged each other. "How are you doing?" she asked. "Good," Thomas said. "I'm good." His speech was thick, but not at all difficult to understand, for his tongue was not as deformed as those of some victims of DS. It was a little larger than it should have been, but not fissured or protruding. "I'm real good. Where's Derek?" "Visiting. Down the hall. He'll be back." "I'm real good. Are you good?" "I'm fine, honey. Just great." "I'm just great, too. I love you, Jules," Thomas said happily. For with Julie, he was always free of the shyness that colored his relations with everyone else.
"I love you so much."
"I love you, too, Thomas."
"I was afraid maybe you wouldn't come."
"Don't I always come?"
"Always," he said.
At last he relaxed his grip on his sister and peeked around her.
"Hi, Bobby."
"Hi, Thomas. You're looking good."
"Am I?"
"If I'm lying, I'm dying." Thomas laughed. To Julie he said,
"He's funny."
"Do I get a hug, too?" Bobby asked. "Or do I have to stand here with my arms out until someone mistakes me for a hat rack?" Hesitantly, Thomas let go of his sister. He and Bobby embraced. After all these years, Thomas was still not entirely comfortable with Bobby, not because they had bad chemistry between them or any bad feelings, but because Thomas didn't like change very much and adapted to it slowly. Even after more than 7 years, his sister being married was a change, something that still felt new to him. "But he likes me," Bobby thought. "Maybe even as much as I like him." Liking DS victims was not difficult once you got past the pity that initially distanced you from them, because most of them had an innocence and guilelessness that was charming and refreshing. Except when inhibited by shyness or embarrassment about their differences, they were usually forthright, more truthful than other people, and incapable of the petty social games and scheming that marred so many relationships among ordinary people. The previous summer at Cielo Vista's 4th of July picnic, a mother of one of the other patients had said to Bobby, "Sometimes watching them, I think there's something in them, a gentleness, a special kindness, that's closer to God than anything in us." Bobby felt the truth of that observation now, as he hugged Thomas and looked down at his sweet, lumpish face.
"Did we interrupt a poem?" Julie asked.
Thomas let go of Bobby and hurried to the work table where Julie was looking at the magazine from which he had been clipping a picture when they'd arrived. He opened his current scrapbook. 14 others were filled with his creations and shelved in a corner bookcase near his bed, and pointed to a 2-page spread of pasted-in clippings that were arranged in lines and quatrains like poetry.
"This was yesterday, finished yesterday," Thomas said. "Took me a long time, and it was hard, but now it is right."
4 or 5 years ago, Thomas had decided he wanted to be a poet, like someone he'd seen and admired on television. The degree of mental retardation among victims of Down syndrome varied widely, from mild to severe. Thomas was somewhere just above the middle of the spectrum, but he did not possess the intellectual capacity to learn to write more than his name. That didn't stop him. He asked for paper, glue, a scrapbook, piles of old magazines. Since he rarely asked for anything, and since Julie would have moved a mountain on her back to get him whatever he wanted, the items on his list were soon in his possession. All kinds of magazines, he'd said, with different pretty pictures, but ugly, too, all kinds. From Time, Newsweek, Life, Hot Rod, Omni, 17, and dozens of other publications, he snipped whole pictures and parts of pictures, arranging them as if they were words in a series of images that made a statement that was important to him. Some of his poems were only 5 images long, and some involved hundreds of clippings arranged in orderly stanzas, or more often in loosely structured lines that resembled free verse. Julie took the scrapbook from him and went to the armchair by the window, where she could concentrate on his newest composition. Thomas remained at the work table, watching her anxiously. His picture poems did not tell stories or have recognizable thematic narratives, but neither were they merely random jumbles of images. A church spire, a mouse, a beautiful woman in an emerald green ball gown, a field of daisies, a can of Dole pineapple rings, a crescent moon, pancakes in a stack with syrup drizzling down, rubies gleaming on a black velvet display cloth, a fish with mouth agape, a child laughing, a nun praying, a woman crying over the blasted body of a loved one in some godforsaken war zone, a pack of lifesavers, a puppy with floppy ears, black-clad nuns with starched white wimples. From those and thousands of other pictures in his treasured boxes of clippings, Thomas selected the elements of his compositions. From the beginning, Bobby recognized an uncanny rightness to many of the poems, a symmetry too fundamental to be defined, juxtapositions that were both naive and profound, rhythms as real as they were elusive, a personal vision plain to see but too mysterious to comprehend to any significant degree. Over the years, Bobby had seen the poems become better, more satisfying, though he understood them so little that he could not explain how he could discern the improvement. He just knew that it was there. Julie looked up from the 2-page spread in the scrapbook and said, "This is wonderful, Thomas. It makes me want to run outside in the grass, stand under the sky, maybe even dance. Just throw my head back and laugh. It makes me glad to be alive." "Yes," Thomas said, slurring the word and clapping his hands. She passed the book to Bobby. He sat on the edge of the bed and read it. The most intriguing thing about Thomas's poems was the emotional response they invariably evoked. None left a reader untouched, as an array of randomly assembled images might have done. Sometimes, when looking at Thomas's work, Bobby laughed out loud, and sometimes he was so moved that he had to blink back tears, and sometimes he felt fear, or sadness, or regret, or wonder. He did not know why he responded to any particular pieces he did. The effect always defied analysis. Thomas's compositions functioned on some primal level, eliciting reaction from a region of the mind far deeper than the subconscious. The latest poem was no exception. Bobby felt what Julie had felt, that life was good, that the world was beautiful, elation in the very fact of existence. He looked up from the scrapbook and saw that Thomas was awaiting his reaction as eagerly as he had awaited Julie's, perhaps a sign that Bobby's opinion was cherished as much as hers, even if he still didn't rate as long or as ardent a hug as Julie did. "Wow," he said softly. "Thomas, this one gives me such a warm, tingly feeling that, well, I think my toes are curling." Thomas grinned. Sometimes, Bobby looked at his brother-in-law and felt that 2 Thomases shared that sadly deformed skull. Thomas number 1 was the moron, sweet but feeble-minded. Thomas number 2 was just as smart as anyone, but he occupied only a small part of the damaged brain that he shared with Thomas number 1, a chamber in the center, from which he had no direct communication with the outside world. All of Thomas No. 2's thoughts had to be filtered through Thomas No. 1's part of the brain, so they ended up sounding no different from Thomas No. 1's thoughts. Therefore, the world could not know that No. 2 was in there, thinking and feeling and fully alive, except through the evidence of the picture poems, the essence of which survived even after being filtered through Thomas No. 1. "You've got such a talent," Bobby said, and he meant it, almost envied it. Thomas blushed and lowered his eyes. He rose and quickly shuffled to the softly humming refrigerator that stood beside the door to the bathroom. Meals were served in the communal dining room where snacks and drinks were provided on request, but patients with sufficient mental capacity to keep their rooms neat were allowed to have their own refrigerators, stocked with their favorite snacks and drinks, to encourage as much independence as possible. He withdrew 3 cans of Coke. He gave 1 to Bobby, 1 to Julie, and with a third, he returned to the chair at the work table, sat down, and said, "You been catching bad guys?" "Yeah, we're keeping the jails full," Bobby said. "Tell me." Julie leaned forward in the armchair, and Thomas scooted his straight-backed chair closer to her until their knees touched, and she recounted the highlights of the events at Decadyne last night. She made Bobby more heroic than he'd really been, and she played down her own involvement a little, not only out of modesty, but in order not to frighten Thomas with too clear a picture of the danger in which she had put herself. Thomas was tough in his own way. If he hadn't been, he would have curled up on his bed long ago, facing into the corner, and never gotten up again. But he was not tough enough to endure the loss of Julie. He would be devastated even to imagine that she was vulnerable. So she made her daredevil driving and the shootout sound funny, exciting but not really dangerous. Her revised version of events entertained Bobby nearly as much as it did Thomas. After a while, as usual, Thomas became overwhelmed by what Julie was telling him, and the tale grew more confusing than entertaining. "I'm full up," he said, which meant he was still trying to process everything he'd been told and didn't have room for any more just now. He was fascinated by the world outside Cielo Vista, and he often longed to be a part of it. But at the same time, he found it too loud and bright and colorful to be handled in more than small doses. Bobby got one of the older scrapbooks from the shelves and sat on the bed, reading picture poems. Thomas and Julie sat in their chairs, cokes put aside, knees to knees, leaning forward and holding hands, sometimes looking at each other, sometimes not, just being together, close. Julie needed that as much as Thomas did. Julie's mother had been killed when Julie was 12. Her father had died 8 years later, 2 years before Bobby and Julie were married. She'd been only 20 at the time, working as a waitress to put herself through college and to pay her half of the rent on a studio apartment she shared with another student. Her parents had never been rich, and though they had kept Thomas at home, the expense of looking after him had depleted what little savings they'd ever had. When her dad died, Julie had been unable to afford an apartment for her and Thomas, to say nothing of the time required to help him cope in a civilian environment. So she'd been forced to commit him to a state institution for mentally disabled children. Though Thomas never held it against her, she viewed the commitment as a betrayal of him. She had intended to get a degree in criminology, but she dropped out of school in her 3rd year and applied to the Sheriff's Academy. She had worked as a deputy for 14 months by the time Bobby met and married her. She'd been living on peanuts. Her lifestyle hardly better than that of a bag lady, saving most of her salary in hope of putting together a nest egg that would allow her to buy a small house someday and take Thomas in with her. Shortly after they were married, when Dakota Investigations became Dakota and Dakota, they brought Thomas to live with them, but they worked irregular hours. And although some victims of Down syndrome were capable of living to a degree on their own, Thomas needed someone nearby at all times. The cost of 3 daily shifts of qualified companions was even more than the cost of high-level care at a private institution like Cielo Vista. But they would have borne it if they could have found enough reliable help. When it became impossible to conduct their business, have a life of their own, and take care of Thomas too, they brought him to Cielo Vista. It was as comfortable a care institution as existed, but Julie viewed it as her second betrayal of her brother. That he was happy at Cielo Vista, even thrived there, did not lighten her burden of guilt. One part of the dream, an important part, was to have the time and financial resources to bring Thomas home again. Bobby looked up from the scrapbook just as Julie said, "Thomas, think you'd like to go out with us for a while?" Thomas and Julie were still holding hands, and Bobby saw his brother-in-law's grip tighten at the suggestion of an excursion. "We could just go for a drive," Julie said. "Down to the sea, walk on the shore, get an ice cream cone. What do you say?" Thomas looked nervously at the nearest window, which framed a portion of clear blue sky where white seagulls periodically swooped and capered.
"It's bad out."
"Well, just a little windy, honey."
"Don't mean the wind."
"We'll have fun."
"It's bad out," he repeated.
He chewed on his lower lip. At times, he was eager to venture out into the world, but at other times, he withdrew from the prospect as if the air beyond Cielo Vista was purest poison. Thomas could never be argued or cajoled out of that agoraphobic mood, and Julie knew not to push the issue. "Well, maybe next time," she said.
"Maybe," Thomas said, looking at the floor. "But today's really bad. I sort of feel it. The badness. Cold. All over my skin."
For a while, Bobby and Julie tried various subjects, but Thomas was talked out. He said nothing, did not make eye contact, and gave no indication that he even heard them. They sat together in silence then, until after a few minutes Thomas said,
"Don't go yet."
"We're not going," Bobby assured him.
"Just 'cause I can't talk don't mean I want you gone."
"We know that, kiddo," Julie said.
"I need you."
"I need you too," Julie said. She lifted one of her brother's thick-fingered hands and kissed his knuckles.
After buying an electric razor at a drugstore, Frank Pollard shaved and washed as best he could in the service station restroom. He stopped at a shopping mall and bought a suitcase, underwear, socks, a couple of shirts, another pair of jeans, and incidentals. In the mall parking lot, with the stolen Chevy rocking slightly in the gusting wind, he packed the other purchases in the suitcase. Then he drove to a motel in Irvine, where he checked in under the name of George Ferris, using one of the sets of ID he possessed, making a cash deposit because he lacked a credit card. He had cash in abundance. He could have stayed in the Laguna area, but he sensed that he should not remain in one place too long. Maybe his wariness was based on hard experience. Or maybe he had been on the run for so long that he had become a creature of motion who could never again be truly comfortable at rest. The motel room was large, clean, and tastefully decorated. The designer had been swept up in the Southwest craze, whitewashed wood, rattan side chairs with cushions upholstered in peach and pale blue patterns, seafoam green drapes. Only the mottled brown carpet, evidently chosen for its ability to conceal stains and wear, spoiled the effect. By contrast, the light-hued furnishing seemed not merely to stand on the dark carpet, but to float above it, creating spatial illusions that were disconcerting, even slightly eerie. For most of the afternoon, Frank sat on the bed, using the pile of pillows as a backrest. The television was on, but he did not watch it. Instead, he probed at the black hole of his past. Hard as he tried, he could still not recall anything of his life prior to waking in the alleyway the previous night. Some strange and exceedingly malevolent shape loomed at the edge of recollection, however, and he wondered uneasily if forgetfulness actually might be a blessing. He needed help. Given the cash in the flight bag and his two sets of ID, he suspected that he would be unwise to seek assistance from the authorities. He withdrew the yellow pages from one of the nightstands and studied the listings for private investigators. But a PI called to mind old Humphrey Bogart movies and seemed like an anachronism in this modern age. How could a guy in a trench coat and a snap-brimmed fedora help him recover his memory? Eventually, with the wind singing threnodies at the window, Frank stretched out to get some of the sleep he had missed last night. A few hours later, just an hour before dusk, he woke suddenly, whimpering, gasping for breath. His heart pounded furiously. When he sat up and swung his legs over the side of the bed, he saw that his hands were wet and scarlet. His shirt and jeans were smeared with blood. Some, though surely not all of it, was his own blood, for both of his hands bore deep, oozing scratches. His face stung, and in the bathroom, the mirror revealed two long scratches on his right cheek, one on his left cheek, and a fourth on his chin. He could not understand how this could have happened in his sleep. If he had torn at himself in some bizarre dream frenzy, and he could recall no dream, or if someone else had clawed him while he slept, he would have awakened at once. Which meant that he had been awake when it had happened, then had stretched out on the bed again and gone back to sleep, and had forgotten the incident, just as he had forgotten his life prior to that alleyway last night. He returned in panic to the bedroom and looked on the other side of the bed, then in the closet. He was not sure what he was looking for. Maybe a dead body. He found nothing. The very thought of killing anyone made him sick. He knew he did not have the capacity to kill, except perhaps in self-defense. So who had scratched his face and hands? Whose blood was on him? In the bathroom again, he stripped out of his stained clothes and rolled them into a tight bundle. He washed his face and hands. He had bought a styptic pencil along with other shaving gear. He used that to stop the scratches from bleeding. When he met his own eyes in the mirror, they were so haunted that he had to look away. Frank dressed in fresh clothes and snatched the car keys off the dresser. He was afraid of what he might find in the Chevy. At the door, as he disengaged the deadbolt, he realized that neither the frame nor the door itself was smeared with blood. If he had left during the afternoon and returned, bleeding from his hands, he would not have had the presence of mind to wipe the door clean before climbing into bed. Anyway, he had seen no bloody washcloth or tissues with which a cleanup might have been accomplished. Outside, the sky was clear. The westering sun was bright. The motel's palm trees shivered in a cool wind, and a constant susurration rose from them, punctuated by an occasional series of hard clacks as the thick spines of the fronds met like snapping wooden teeth. The concrete walkway outside his room was not spotted with blood. The interior of the car was free of blood. No blood marked the dirty rubber mat in the trunk, either. He stood by the open trunk, blinking at the sun-washed motel and parking lot around him. Three doors down, a man and woman in their 20s were unloading luggage from their black Pontiac. Another couple and their grade-school-aged daughter were hurrying along the covered walkway, apparently heading toward the motel restaurant. Frank realized that he could not have gone out and committed murder and returned, blood-soaked and in broad daylight, without being seen. In his room again, he went to the bed and studied the rumpled sheets. They were crimson-spotted, but not a fraction as saturated as they would have been if the attack, whatever its nature, had happened there. Of course, if all the blood was his, it might have spilled mostly on the front of his shirt and jeans. But he could still not believe that he had clawed himself in his sleep, one hand ripping at the other, both hands tearing at his face, without waking. Besides, he had been scratched by someone with sharp fingernails. His own nails were blunt, bitten down to the quick.
South of Cielo Vista Care Home, between Corona del Mar and Laguna, Bobby tucked the samurai into a corner of a parking lot at a public beach. He and Julie walked down to the shore. The sea was marbled blue and green, with thin veins of gray. The water was dark in the troughs, lighter and more colorful where the waves rose and were half-pierced by the rays of the fat, low sun. In serried ranks, the breakers moved toward the strand, big but not huge, wearing caps of foam that the wind snatched from them. Surfers in black wetsuits paddled their boards out toward where the swell rose, seeking a last ride before twilight. Others, also in wetsuits, sat around a couple of big coolers drinking hot beverages from thermos bottles or Coors from the can. The day was too cool for sunbathing, and except for the surfers, the beach was deserted. Bobby and Julie walked south until they found a low knoll, far enough back from the water to escape the spray. They sat on the stiff grass that flourished in patches in the sandy, salt-tinged soil. When at last she spoke, Julie said, "A place like this, with a view like this, not a big place. Doesn't have to be. A living room, one bedroom for us, one for Thomas. Maybe a cozy little den lined with books. We don't even need a dining room, but I'd like a big kitchen." "Yeah, a kitchen you can really live in." She sighed. "Music, books, real home-cooked meals instead of junk food grabbed on the fly. Lots of time to sit on the porch and enjoy the view, and the three of us together." That was the rest of The Dream, a place by the sea, and, by otherwise living simply, enough financial security to retire 20 years early. One of the things that had drawn Bobby to Julie and Julie to him was their shared awareness of the shortness of life. Oh, everyone knew that life was too short, of course, but most people pushed that thought out of their mind, living as if there were endless tomorrows. If most people weren't able to deceive themselves about death, they could not have cared so passionately about the outcome of a ball game, the plot of a soap opera, the blatherings of politicians, or a thousand other things that actually meant nothing when considered against the inevitable fall of the endless night that finally came to everyone. They could not have endured to waste a minute standing in a supermarket line, and would not have suffered hours in the company of bores and fools. Maybe a world lay beyond this one, maybe even heaven, but you couldn't count on it. You could count only on darkness. Self-deception, in this case, was a blessing. Neither Bobby nor Julie was a gloom-monger. She knew how to enjoy life as well as anyone, and so did he. Even if neither of them could buy the fragile illusion of immortality that served most people as a defense against the unthinkable, their awareness expressed itself not in anxiety or depression, but in a strong resolve not to spend their lives in a hurly-burly of meaningless activity, to find a way to finance long stretches of time together in their own serene little tide pool. As her chestnut hair streamed in the wind, Julie squinted at the far horizon, which was filling up with honey-gold light as the sinking sun drizzled toward it. "What frightens Thomas about being out of the world is people, too many people. But he'd be happy in a little house by the sea, a quiet stretch of coast, few people. I'm sure he would." "It'll happen," Bobby assured her. "By the time we build the agency big enough to sell, the southern coast will be too expensive. But north of Santa Barbara's pretty." "It's a long coast," Bobby said, putting an arm around her. "We'll still be able to find a place in the south. And we'll have time to enjoy it. We're not going to live forever, but we're young. Our numbers aren't going to come up for years and years yet." But he remembered the premonition that had shivered through him in bed that morning after they had made love, the feeling that something malevolent was out there in the windswept worlds coming to take Julie away from him. The sun had touched the horizon and begun to melt into it. The golden light deepened swiftly to orange and then to bloody red. The grass and tall weeds behind them rustled in the wind, and Bobby looked over his shoulder at the spirals of airborne sand that swirled across the slope between the beach and the parking lot, like pale spirits that had fled a graveyard with the coming of twilight. From the east, a wall of night was toppling over the world. The air had grown downright cold.
Candy slept all day in the front bedroom that had once been his mother's, breathing her special scent. Two or three times a week, he carefully shook a few drops of her favorite perfume, Chanel No. 5, onto a white lace-trimmed handkerchief, which he kept on the dresser beside her silver comb and brush set, so each breath he took in the room reminded him of her. Occasionally, he half woke from slumber to readjust the pillows or pull the covers more tightly around him, and the trace of perfume always lulled him as if it were a tranquilizer. Each time, he happily drifted back into his dreams. He slept in sweatpants and a T-shirt because he had a hard time finding pajamas large enough, and because he was too modest to sleep in the nude or even in his underwear. Being unclothed embarrassed Candy, even when no one was around to see him. All of that long Thursday afternoon, hard winter sun filled the world outside. But little got past the flower-patterned shades and rose-colored drapes that guarded the two windows. The few times he woke and blinked at the shadows, Candy saw only the pearl-gray glimmer of the dresser mirror and glints from the silver-framed photographs on the nightstand. Drugged by sleep and by the freshly applied perfume on the handkerchief, he could easily imagine that his beloved mother was in her rocking chair, watching over him, and he felt safe. He came fully awake shortly before sunset and lay for a while with his hands folded behind his head, staring up at the underside of the canopy that arched over the four-poster. He could not see it, but he knew it was there, and in his mind he could conjure up a vivid image of the fabric's rosebud pattern. For a while he thought about his mother, about the best times of his life, now all gone, and then he thought about the girl, the boy, and the woman he had killed last night. He tried to recall the taste of their blood, but that memory was not as intense as those involving his mother. After a while, he switched on a bedside lamp and looked around at the comfortably familiar room. Rosebud wallpaper, rosebud bedspread, rosebud blinds, rose-colored drapes and carpets, dark mahogany bed, dresser, and highboy. Two afghans, one green, like the leaves of a rose, one the shade of the petals, were draped over the arms of the rocking chair. He went into the adjoining bathroom, locked and tested the door. The only light came from the fluorescent panels in the soffit over the sink, for he had long ago lathered black paint on the small, high window. He studied his face in the mirror for a moment because he liked the way he looked. He could see his mother in his face. He had her blonde hair, so pale it was almost white, and her sea-blue eyes. His face was all hard planes and strong features, with none of her beauty or gentleness, though his full mouth was as generous as hers. As he undressed, he avoided looking down at himself. He was proud of his powerful shoulders and arms, his broad chest, and his muscular legs. But even catching a glimpse of the sex thing made him feel dirty and mildly ill. He sat on the toilet to make water so he wouldn't have to touch himself. During his shower, when he soaped his crotch, he first pulled on a mitten that he had sewn from a pair of washcloths so the flesh of his hand would not have to touch the wicked flesh below. When he had dried off and dressed, athletic socks, running shoes, dark gray cords, black shirt, he hesitantly left the reliable shelter of his mother's old room. Night had fallen, and the upstairs hall was poorly lit by two low-wattage bulbs in a ceiling fixture that was coated with gray dust and missing half its pendant crystals. To his left was the head of the staircase. To his right were his sister's room, his old room, and the other bath, the doors to which stood open. No lights were on back there. The oak floor creaked, and the threadbare runner did little to soften his footsteps. He sometimes thought he should give the rest of the house a thorough cleaning, maybe even spring for some new carpeting and fresh paint. However, though he kept his mother's room spotless and in good repair, he was not motivated to spend time or money on the rest of the house, and his sisters had little interest in or talent for homemaking. A flurry of soft footfalls alerted him to the approach of the cats, and he stopped short of the stairs, afraid of treading on one of their paws or tails as they poured into the upstairs hall. A moment later, they streamed over the top step and swarmed around him. 26 of them, if his most recent count was not out of date. 11 were black, several more were chocolate brown or tobacco brown or charcoal gray. 2 were deep gold, and only one was white, violet, and verbena, his sisters, preferred dark cats, the darker, the better. The animals milled around him, walking over his shoes, rubbing against his legs, curling their tails around his calves. Among them were two Angoras, an Abyssinian, a tailless Manx, a Maltese, and a tortoiseshell. But most were mongrel cats of no easily distinguished lineage. Some had green eyes, some yellow, some silver gray, some blue, and they all regarded him with great interest. Not one of them purred or meowed. Their inspection was conducted in absolute silence. Candy did not particularly like cats, but he tolerated these not only because they belonged to his sisters, but because, in a way, they were virtually an extension of Violet and Verbena. To have hurt them, to have spoken harshly to them, would have been the same as striking out at his sisters, which he could never do, because his mother, on her deathbed, had admonished him to provide for the girls and protect them. In less than a minute, the cats had fulfilled their mission, and almost as one, turned from him. With much swishing of tails and flexing of feline muscles and rippling of fur, they flowed like a single beast to the head of the stairs and down. By the time he reached the first step, they were at the landing, turning, slipping out of sight. He descended to the lower hall, and the cats were gone. He passed the lightless and musty-smelling parlor. The odor of mildew drifted out of the study, where shelves were filled with the moldering romance novels that his mother had liked so much, and when he passed through the dimly lit dining room, litter crunched under his shoes. Violet and Verbena were in the kitchen. They were identical twins. They were equally blonde, with the same fair and faultless skin, with the same china-blue eyes, smooth brows, high cheekbones, straight noses with delicately carved nostrils, lips that were naturally red without lipstick, and small, even teeth as bone-white as those of their cats. Candy tried to like his sisters and failed. For his mother's sake, he could not dislike them. So he remained neutral, sharing the house with them, but not as a real family might share it. They were too thin, he thought, fragile-looking, almost frail, and too pale, like creatures that infrequently saw the sun, which in fact seldom warmed them since they rarely went outside. Their slim hands were well manicured, for they groomed themselves as constantly as if they, too, were cats. But to Candy, their fingers seemed excessively long, unnaturally flexible and nimble. Their mother had been robust, with strong features and good color, and Candy often wondered how such a vital woman could have spawned this pallid pair. The twins had piled up cotton blankets, six thick, in one corner of the big kitchen to make a large area where the cats could lie comfortably, though the padding was actually for Violet and Verbena, so they could sit on the floor among the cats for hours at a time. When Candy entered the room, they were on the blankets with cats all around them and in their laps. Violet was filing Verbena's fingernails with an emery board. Neither of them looked up, though of course they had already greeted him through the cats. Verbena had never spoken a word within Candy's hearing, not in her entire 25 years. The twins were 4 years younger than he was, but he was not sure whether she was unable to talk, merely unwilling to talk, or shy of talking only when around him. Violet was nearly as silent as her sister, but she did speak when necessary. Apparently, at the moment, she had nothing that needed to be said. He stood by the refrigerator, watching them as they huddled over Verbena's pale right hand, grooming it, and he supposed that he was unfair in his judgment of them. Other men might find them attractive in a strange way. Though to him, their limbs seemed too thin, other men might see them as supple and erotic, like the legs of dancers and the arms of acrobats. Their skin was clear as milk, and their breasts were full. Because he was blessedly free of any interest in sex, he was not qualified to judge their appeal. They habitually wore as little as possible, as little as he would tolerate, before ordering them to put on more clothes. They kept the house excessively warm in winter, and most often dressed, as now, in T-shirts and short shorts or panties, barefoot and bare-limbed. Only his mother's room, which was now his, was kept cooler, because he had closed the vents up there. Without his presence to demand a degree of modesty, they would have roamed the house in the nude. Lazily, lazily, Violet filed Verbena's thumbnail, and they both stared at it as intently as if the meaning of life was to be read in the curve of the half-moon or the arc of the nail itself. Candy raided the refrigerator, removing a chunk of canned ham, a package of Swiss cheese, mustard, pickles, and a quart of milk. He got bread from one of the cupboards and sat in a rail-back chair at the age-yellowed table. The table, chairs, cabinets, and woodwork had once been glossy white, but they had not been painted since before his mother died. They were yellow-white now, gray-white in the seams and corners, crackle-finished by time. The daisy-patterned wallpaper was soiled and in a couple of places peeling along the seams, and the chintz curtains hung limp with grease and dust. Candy made and consumed two thick ham and cheese sandwiches. He gulped the milk straight from the carton. Suddenly, all 26 cats, which had been sprawling languidly around the twins, sprang up simultaneously, proceeded to the pet door in the bottom of the larger kitchen door, and went outside in orderly fashion. Time to make their toilet, evidently. Violet and Verbena didn't want the house smelling of litter boxes. Candy closed his eyes and took a long swallow of milk. He would have preferred it at room temperature or even slightly warm. It tasted vaguely like blood, though not as pleasantly pungent. It would have been more like blood if it had not been chilled. Within a couple of minutes, the cats returned. Now Verbena was lying on her back, with her head propped on a pillow, eyes closed, lips moving as if talking to herself, though no sound issued from her. She extended her other slender hand so her sister could meticulously file those nails, too. Her long legs were spread, and Candy could see between her smooth thighs. She was wearing only a T-shirt and flimsy peach-colored panties that defined, rather than concealed, the cleft of her womanhood. The silent cats swarmed to her, draped themselves over her, more concerned about propriety than she was. And they regarded Candy accusatorily, as if they knew that he'd been staring. He lowered his eyes and studied the crumbs on the table. Violet said, "Frankie was here." At first he was more surprised by the fact that she had spoken than by what she had said. Then the meaning of those three words reverberated through him as if he were a brass gong struck by a mallet. He stood up so abruptly that he knocked over his chair. "He was here in the house?" Neither the cats nor Verbena twitched at the crash of the chair or the sharpness of his voice. They lay somnolent, indifferent. "Outside," Violet said, still sitting on the floor beside her reclining sister, working on the other twin's nails. She had a low, almost whispery voice. "Outside, watching the house from the Eugenia hedge." Candy glanced at the night beyond the windows.
"When?"
"Around 4 o'clock."
"Why didn't you wake me?"
"He wasn't here long. He's never here long. A minute or two, then he goes. He's afraid."
"You saw him?"
"I knew he was there."
"You didn't try to stop him from leaving?"
"How could I?" She sounded irritable now, but her voice was no less seductive than it had been. "The cats went after him, though."
"Did they hurt him?"
"A little. Not bad. But he killed Samantha."
"Who?"
"Our poor little puss, Samantha." Candy did not know the cats' names. They had always seemed to be not just a pack of cats, but a single creature, most often moving as one, apparently thinking as one. "He killed Samantha. Smashed her head against one of the stone pilasters at the end of the walk." At last Violet looked up from her sister's hand. Her eyes seemed to be a paler blue than before, icy. "I want you to hurt him, Candy. I want you to hurt him real bad, the way he hurt our cat. I don't care if he is our brother."
"He isn't our brother anymore, not after what he did,"
Candy said furiously. "I want you to do to him what he did to our poor Samantha. I want you to smash him, Candy. I want you to crush his head, crack his skull open until his brains ooze out." She continued to speak softly, but he was riveted by her words. Sometimes, like now, when her voice was even more sensuous than usual, It seemed not merely to play upon his ears, but to slither into his head, where it lay gently on his brain like a mist, a fog. "I want you to pound him, hit him, and tear him until he's just splintered bones and ruptured guts, and I want you to rip out his eyes. I want him to be sorry he hurt Samantha." Kendi shook himself. "If I get my hands on him, I'll kill him, all right. But not because of what he did to your cat, because of what he did to our mother. Don't you remember what he did to her? How can you worry about getting revenge for a cat when we still haven't made him pay for our mother after 7 long years? She looked stricken, turned her face from him, and fell silent. The cats flowed off Verbena's recumbent form. Violet stretched out half atop her sister, half beside her. She put her head on Verbena's breasts. Their bare legs were entwined. Rising part of the way out of her trance-like state, Verbena stroked her sister's silken hair. The cats returned and cuddled against both twins wherever there was a warm hollow to welcome them. "Frank was here," Candy said aloud, but largely to himself, and his hands curled into tight fists. A fury grew in him like a small turning wheel of wind far out on the sea, but soon to whirl itself into a hurricane. However, rage was an emotion he dared not indulge. He must control himself. A storm of rage would water the seeds of his dark need. His mother would approve of killing Frank, for Frank had betrayed the family. His death would benefit the family. But if Candy let his anger at his brother swell into a rage, then was unable to find Frank, he would have to kill someone else, because the need would be too great to deny. His mother in heaven would be ashamed of him, and for a while she would turn her face from him and deny that she had ever given birth to him. Looking up at the ceiling toward the unseen sky and the place at God's court where his mother dwelled, Candy said, "I'll be okay. I won't lose control. I won't." He turned from his sisters and the cats, and he went outside to see if any trace of Frank remained near the Eugenia hedge or at the pilaster where he had killed Samantha.
Bobby and Julie ate dinner at Ozzy's in Orange, then shifted to the adjoining bar. The music was provided by Eddie Day, who had a smooth, supple voice. He played contemporary stuff, but also tunes from the 50s and early 60s. It wasn't big band, but some early rock and roll had a swing beat. They could swing to numbers like Dream Lover, Rumba to La Bamba, and Cha-Cha to any disco ditty that crept into Eddie's repertoire, so they had a good time. Whenever possible, Julie liked to go dancing after she visited Thomas at Cielo Vista. In the thrall of the music, keeping time to the beat, focused on the patterns of the dance, she was able to put everything else out of her mind, even guilt, even grief. Nothing else freed her so completely. Bobby liked to dance, too, especially swing. Tuck in, throw out, change places, sugar push, do a tight whip, tuck in again, throw out, trade places with both hands linked, back to basic position. Music soothed, but dance had the power to fill the heart with joy and to numb those parts of it that were bruised. During the musicians' break, Bobby and Julie sipped beer at a table near the edge of the parquet dance floor. They talked about everything except Thomas, and eventually they got around to the dream, especially how to furnish the seaside bungalow if they ever bought it. Though they would not spend a fortune on furniture, they agreed that they could indulge themselves in two pieces from the swing era, maybe a bronze and marble Art Deco cabinet by Emile Jacques Ruhlmann, and definitely a Wurlitzer jukebox. "The Model 950, Julie said. "It was gorgeous. Bubble tubes, leaping gazelles on the front panels. Fewer than 4,000 were made. Hitler's fault. Wurlitzer retooled for war production. The Model 500 is pretty, too. Or the 700. Nice, but they're not the 950. Not as expensive as the 950 either. Well, you're counting pennies when we're talking ultimate beauty?" He said, "Ultimate beauty is the Wurlitzer 950. That's right. What else? Well, to me, you're the ultimate beauty. Oh, sweet, she said, but I still want the 950. To you, aren't I the ultimate beauty? He batted his eyelashes. To me, you are a difficult man who won't let me have my Wurlitzer 950, she said, enjoying the game. Well, what about a Seaberg, a Packard Playmore? Okay, a Rockola. Rockola made some beautiful boxes, she agreed. We'll buy one of those and the Wurlitzer 950. You'll spend our money like a drunken sailor. Well, I was born to be rich. Stork got confused. Didn't deliver me to the Rockefellers. Wouldn't you like to get your hands on that stork now? Oh, caught him years ago. Cooked him, ate him for Christmas dinner. He was delicious, but I'd still rather be a Rockefeller. Happy? Bobby asked. Delirious. And it's not just the beer. I don't know why, but tonight I feel better than I've felt in ages. I think we're going to get where we want to go, Bobby. I think we're going to retire early and live a long, happy life by the sea. His smile faded as she talked. Now he was frowning. She said, what's wrong with you, sourpuss? Nothing. Don't kid me. You've been a little strange all day. You've tried to hide it, but something's on your mind. He sipped his beer. Then, well, you've got this good feeling that everything's going to be fine, but I've got this bad feeling. You, Mr. Blue Skies? He was still frowning. Maybe you should confine yourself to office work for a while. Stay off the firing line. Why? My bad feeling. Which is? That I'm going to lose you. Just try.
With its invisible baton, the wind conducted a chorus of whispery voices in the hedgerow. The dense Eugenias formed a 7-foot-high wall around 3 sides of the 2-acre property, and they would have been higher than the house itself if Candy had not used power trimmers to chop off the tops of them a couple of times each year. He opened the waist-high wrought-iron gate between the 2 stone pilasters and stepped out into the graveled shoulder of the county road. To his left, the 2-lane blacktop wound up into the hills for another couple of miles. To his right, it dropped down toward the distant coast, past houses on lots that were more parsimoniously proportioned the nearer they were to the shore, until in town they were only a tenth as big as the Pollard place. As the land descended westward, lights were clustered in ever greater concentration, then stopped abruptly, several miles away, as if crowding against a black wall. That wall was the night sky and the lightless expanse of the deep, cold sea. Candy moved along the high hedge until he sensed that he had reached the place where Frank had stood. He held up both big hands, letting the wind-fluttered leaves tremble against his palms as if the foliage might impart to him some psychic residue of his brother's brief visit. Nothing. Parting the branches, he peered through the gap at the house, which looked larger at night than it really was, as if it had 18 or 20 rooms instead of 10. The front windows were dark. Along the side, toward the back, where the light was filtered through greasy chintz curtains, a kitchen window was filled with a yellow glow. But for that one light, the house might have appeared abandoned. Some of the Victorian gingerbread had warped and broken away from the eaves. The porch roof was sagging, and a few railing balusters were broken, and the front steps were sway-backed. Even by the meager light of the low crescent moon, he could see the house needed painting. Bare wood, like glimpses of dark bone, showed in many places, and the remaining paint was either peeling or as translucent as an albino skin. Candy tried to put himself in Frank's mind, to imagine why Frank kept returning. Frank was afraid of Candy, and he had reason to be. He was afraid of his sisters, too, and of all the memories that the house held for him, so he should have stayed away. But he crept back with frequency in search of something, perhaps something that even he did not understand. Frustrated, Candy let the branches fall together, retraced his steps along the hedge, and stopped at one gatepost, then the other, searching for the spot where Frank had fended off the cats and smashed Samantha's skull.